That call for clergy from across the country, forever changed the way our country formed and the way this denomination formed. The events of Bloody Sunday and the events leading up to Bloody Sunday had been horrible. And the fact that it was televised changed the entire conversation. People had been beaten before. Jimmie Lee Jackson had been killed just a week before. But none of that had been televised, and very little of that had been in the news. On Bloody Sunday, reporters watched and videotaped and reported the violence of an out-of-control sheriff trying to make a point. Tear gas, wounds, people running for their lives, women and children. And when that call came out at 4 a.m. the next Monday, the next morning, immediately ministers and lay leaders began to plan their journey to Selma. Within the first 48 hours from that call, 45 ministers and 15 lay leaders were in Selma from as far away as Seattle, Berkeley, Boston, Florida, Michigan, and Canada. Already on planes that day were ministers from England and lay leaders from India. And collections were being taken in Transylvania and the world around. Our denomination replied and responded immediately and with force, and were forever transformed and changed. Before I get too far into our story, I want to tell you a little bit about what Montgomery and Selma and the world of Alabama is like today. I think we've heard the stories. We know a lot about what's going on in the history of the South. But how does the South continue to live on with it today? I served a congregation in Montgomery, Alabama for 2 years before I came here. And there were a number of things that surprised me. Perhaps one of the most shocking things that I first saw was this image. This is the Great Seal of the City of Montgomery, and on the outside it reads, or in the center circle it reads, birthplace of the civil rights movement. And on the star in the middle it reads, cradle of the Confederacy. And if that is not a definition of what the world is like in Alabama at this time, particularly in Selma and Montgomery, I don't think anything is. Because this is a place that is trying to live with a dual history. It is not shying away from its civil rights history. And in many ways, Selma, Montgomery, Tuskegee, Birmingham, they are proud of the work that they have done, and as well they should be. They continue to do amazing work to this day. That consent decree that Ferguson is expected to sign in the coming weeks, Montgomery and Selma and Birmingham and places in Mississippi did that work 50 years ago. And yet so many places have yet to do it today. The reason why the birthplace of the civil rights movement is placed there so proudly is because some of the most amazing activists of our times, most amazing work of our world was done in Alabama and in Mississippi and in Georgia and in Arkansas and Louisiana. And that center bit, the star, with the cradle of the Confederacy, well, that comes from another star. So if you go to the next slide, this is on the front steps of the Capitol in Montgomery, Alabama. It is a little star that was placed there in honor of Jefferson Davis. Anybody know who Jefferson Davis is? First president of the, and only president, happily, of the Confederacy. In fact, this star was so beloved that when John Kennedy himself came to visit Montgomery, Alabama, they placed a barrier around it to make sure that he would not spoil this consecrated and holy and sacred place with his liberalism. The Star of David is a symbol of the daughters of the Confederacy. And this star was a gift from the daughters of the Confederacy in honor of Jefferson Davis. The picture you see here is at a protest for voting rights for African Americans that happened last spring. As new voting laws make it more and more difficult for people of color and people of minority communities to vote because they don't have the requisite ID. And so we're reminded, as much work as has been done, there is still more to do. The next slide, we can see a bit of the history of Montgomery and of the South. Montgomery, Alabama was the center of the domestic slave trade. Once slave transportation was made illegal and it was not possible to import slaves from Africa anymore, the biggest trade was in domestic slaves that were already here. And most of them were sold out of Montgomery. And in fact, until the past 20 years, the majority of people living in Montgomery, Alabama were black. When you look at this picture, you see the history of the city and of the state. Where that water fountain is where they used to sell slaves. That was the selling block until recent history. On the right corner, that very first store used to be the telegraph office. And that is where Robert E. Lee received a telegraph, or it was Jefferson Davis sent the telegraph to Robert E. Lee to start the Civil War. And in the left, two stores in, is where Rosa Parks worked and was where she came from to get on that bus, where she refused to get up. And this street is called Dexter Avenue. And so as you might imagine, that big spire on the right is Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King preached many, many times during the Montgomery bus boycott. And at the very end, you can see the little white dome. That is the Congress, the building where that Star of David sits. All of that history in one picture. All of that history in one place. And Selma is no different. You can walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, Edmund Pettus being a Ku Klux Klan member, as well as the founder of many things. You can visit the stores, and very little has changed. It looks very much now as it did 50 years ago. And you can see signs supporting the civil rights movement, and you see signs celebrating Confederate leaders. A world mired in history. And yet the power of that history is that they don't hide it. I think we could learn a lot from our southern neighbors as Northerners and not hide our history. What would it mean to have a monument to the riots in East St. Louis? What it would mean to have a monument to the white flight supported by the home ownership programs? And the history of the modern day in Montgomery leads to some fascinating paradoxes. If you go to the next slide, this sign greets you as you're walking out of the electricity office in Montgomery. And it is the site of the first and only White House of the Confederacy. And if you go to the next slide, that's where the White House used to be. It is now a skate park, which I think is wonderful. What they did was they picked up the White House and they moved it, and it's still there and it's a museum. But I do hope that Jefferson Davis is rolling in his grave as he recognizes that skateboarders and tweakers and everybody and their mother is probably hanging out on his old place. The next slide is from Jefferson Davis Highway. This marker is on the property of the first the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Montgomery and cannot be moved because it is a historic marker. The street has long since been changed to Atlanta Highway, but to most of the locals, it's still Jefferson Davis Highway. And just a few blocks from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Montgomery is the Robert E. Lee High School, which is 95% African American. A lot has changed. And so one has to ask, how do you get such a dichotomous history in such a place? And some of that is obvious. In the summer of 64, much effort had been placed in trying to create voting rights. And at the end of 64, Martin Luther King Jr. and the members of SCLC had gone to determine, was Selma a ripe place for moving the civil rights movement forward? How many of you have seen the movie Selma now? Really? I really encourage you to see it. It is very well done. And James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo are in it. There's definitely a nod to Unitarian Universalists in that film. But they do show that when he arrived, Martin Luther King Jr. arrived in town, he was punched by a white person for trying to get a hotel room in Selma. And this told them that because that level of violence was acceptable and the tension was so palpable, that this would be a place where they could effect change. Because what people pay attention to is violence, not peacefulness. In that summer of 64, just before all of this happened, three lay volunteers who were Unitarian Universalists named James Chaney, Mickey Schwerna, and Andy Goodman disappeared while trying to help people vote in Mississippi. And their bodies were found 6 weeks later. Already white folks were being killed and disappeared in the Deep South. But these were isolated incidences and they were often unheard of. There were already ministers of the Unitarian Universalist Association in Selma. One of those was Gordon Gibson. He left for Selma the day after his ordination, and he said on the day of his ordination he received lots of advice, but the one that stuck with him was from a Reverend Olson, who said, "Don't go to Selma unless it's more important to you to go than to come back." Knowing for certain that there was a good chance you might not return. I have to say, Gordon's still there. I love him. He's a great guy. He is feisty and in his 80s and tells stories like you wouldn't believe. And he continues to fight for voting rights in the South to this day. And actually, during the time in which Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed, Gordon Gibson and another one of his colleagues were in the Selma jail, had been arrested for marching on the sidewalks without permission. Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed in Marion, which is just a little ways from Selma, Alabama. He and his parents had been running because they had been at a march and the police had started to attack. And they ran into a restaurant to try and get away, and the state police, the state troopers, found them and started beating on his parents. In an effort to get them to stop beating on his elderly parents, one state trooper shot him twice in the chest and left him to die. That barely made the news. That was February 26th, 1965. And so it was, just 11 days later, on March 7th, 1965, that a group of African Americans from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and from SCLC marched across Edmund Pettus Bridge with the intention of marching to Montgomery, Alabama, some 50 miles away. And to give you a sense of how far 50 miles is, if you march from Wentzville, Missouri, to Greenville, Illinois, that's 50 miles. No small march, that. Before they could even get across the bridge, they were beaten, they were gassed, many were injured severely, and as I mentioned, it was all caught on tape. And so that next morning, the call for ministers went out, and as I said, 45 within 48 hours, 60 within 2 days, and that was 10% of the Unitarian Universalist ministry, as well as 30-plus lay leaders and many more on their way. In those first 48 hours, there were 80 marches in cities across the world. And by March 9th, they were ready to march again with more than 10,000 people in the city of Selma. It is at this time that Orloff Miller, Clark Olson, and James Reeb arrived. They were there on that first day. And on that night, the first night after the call of being in Selma, they had been in Selma for just a few hours, not very long at all, and were eating at a local restaurant that was integrated. And as they walked back to the local Baptist church where things were being organized, a group of white men surrounded them and beat them with clubs. Clark Olson and Orloff Miller are still alive today, and both recount that they can still hear clearly in their minds the loud crack of the billy club against Jim Reeb's head. They were all beaten, but not all of them had been given the information on what to do in the event of being beaten, and so not all of them protected themselves appropriately. It took a long time to get James Reeb to the hospital in Birmingham, Alabama, because the ambulance broke down. Its tire went flat. It didn't have a siren. And they weren't sure if this was intentional or not, but they waited for a second ambulance and realized they couldn't keep traveling because there were cars driving by, checking on them and clearly waiting for a moment to attack. So they had to wait for somebody from the organizing committees to get a car that had a radio in it, because the radio wasn't working in the ambulance, to get them to Birmingham safely. They asked for an escort. The police refused. In what should have taken 2.5 to 3 hours to get Jim Reeb to the Birmingham hospital, it took them the entire night. And they were not in time. Despite calling the best neurosurgeon in the state of Alabama, he died 2 days later on March 11th. The decision of his wife, Marie, to pull the plug because she didn't think that the life-saving measures were helping him anymore. Within those next few days, there were so many memorial services. What is interesting is the violence did not end. That Saturday after he died, Unitarian Universalist Reverend Albert D'Orlando's home was firebombed in New Orleans as he was writing a eulogy for Jim Reeb. And the next day, his congregation was bombed. Violence continued well on after Bloody Sunday. And people kept showing up because that's what we do. That's what we do. But this was a game changer for Unitarian Universalism. This is not what we had always done. We often spoke of equality, but we hadn't quite understood how to realize it. And World War II changed that. We became a more interfaith denomination because of World War II, and we became more open to diversity because of World War II. If we were going to stand against Nazism, then we had to stand against racial segregation. And we had to say yes to people who did not typically attend our congregations. In 1963, a survey of all the denominations' congregations showed that only 12 congregations had 5 or more African Americans attending. And of those, all of them were in the West, except for one. We still had a lot of work to do. The death of Jim Reeb and the death of Viola Luzzo changed that, because we said, these are our people. And we started to show up in droves, and we started to say no more in our communities. And so we remember. If we go to the next slide. That is the Edmund Pettus Bridge as it stands today, and I would like to thank Mary Johnson for this photo, which she took just a couple of weeks ago, in fact. It looks very much today as it did 50 years ago, down to the sign. In the next slide. And this is Reverend Jim Reeb. Next. So today we remember the people who gave their lives, who were martyred, so that people may be able to vote, so they may live into one of our most important values, our fifth principle as Unitarian Universalists, the right of the democratic process, the right to be heard to have all voices present. Each of those pictures that you see on the wall represents someone who was killed in the civil rights movement around voting rights. Next. When you go to the Civil Rights Memorial in downtown Montgomery, you have the opportunity of looking around these rooms and seeing these places. You also have the opportunity of seeing a documentary video that tells the stories of various civil rights leaders, including that of Viola Liuzzo. She had been a Unitarian Universalist for all of a year when she died. Can you imagine? She was very little known. In fact, her memorial service occurred without any Unitarian Universalist present because her husband wished she had stayed Catholic. Some of us know that story. Next slide. Today, there is a marker on Highway 80 that shows where she died. People drive down that highway every day, back and forth, because the Montgomery Airport is there. Montgomery houses one of our major Air Force bases and officer training schools. And so people drive by this site on a regular basis. It's worth noting that the military has been a liberalizing force in Montgomery and in Selma. Hard to imagine for some, but it is true. And the next slide. So if you go into downtown Montgomery, you can see this table. It has water that flows off, and it shows all the people who were martyred for the Voting Rights Act, including Viola and Jim Reeb. Their lives have shaped us in unimaginable ways. Unitarian Universalism from that day onward became an institution, a denomination of action, and of saying yes to people of community. The people who went to the civil rights marches in Selma in 1965, many of them became the leaders of change in Unitarian Universalism thereafter. From the Black Empowerment Movement that happened just 2 years later, to the work of LGBT equality, which happened just a few years later. In fact, Eugene Navias and Jim Stoll, two of the forerunners of marriage equality and LGBT equality in our churches, were at those marches that very year. It wasn't all easy, though. One of our gay ministers was told that if he went to the march, he could just take his boyfriend with him and never return to that church because they would not support him. Many ministers and lay leaders were told that if they went to the marches that summer, they would not be welcome anymore. And just as many churches ponied up money to send members. In fact, Clark Olson was a member, or was the minister at the UU Fellowship in Berkeley, California, could not afford to go, heard the call, and tried to figure out how, and as soon as he got to his office that morning, two members had said, "We will pay for you to go." We have made it possible, and at the same time, we have been our own hindrance in making things possible. Just like that seal in Montgomery. Cradle of the Confederacy, birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement. We are paradoxical creatures, we human beings. And yet, we continue to move forward. We continue to work towards justice. We continue to have that arc that bend towards justice, as Theodore Parker put it and Dr. King quoted later. It's worth noting that this changed our lives and the lives of so many. That very next year, Dr. Martin Luther King came to the Ware Lecture at our General Assembly and spoke one of the best speeches I've ever heard him give. And we started to change. We made Eyes on the Prize possible. We created About Your Sexuality. And women started to say, "We need a place at the table." We worked with vigilance, with patience and hope for a world transformed by our care, for a vision of the future of what's possible. And we continue to do so today. So as we listen about Ferguson, as we listen about all of the things going on in our world, as we continue to be at the forefront of LGBT equality in our denomination, may we as a congregation and as people in these pews remember who helped make it possible for us to do these things. May it be so.